Chapter 18. On the night before the Dalai Lama's reception, I am tired but I cannot sleep. A. Bedick is away, staying at Joe Kung with George and Jigme, and the 30 loads of construction material that should have come in yesterday, but that were held up in the Fisher City by a porter strike. A. Bedick will hire new porters in the morning and lead the procession the last few kilometers to the temple. Restless, I roll off my futon and slip into whipcord trousers, a faded shirt, my boots, and the light therm jacket. When I step out of my sleeping pagoda, I notice lantern light warming the opaque windows and shoji door of Ania's pagoda. She is working late again. Walking softly so as not to disturb her by rocking the platform, I clamber down a ladder to the main level of the temple hanging in air. It always amazes me how empty this place is at night. At first I thought it was the result of the construction workers, most of whom live in the cliffside crates around Joe Kung, being gone. But I've come to realize how few people spend their nights in the temple complex. George and Jigme usually sleep in their foreman's shack, but are in Joe Kung with A. Bedick tonight. The abbot Kempo Nga Wang Tashi stays with the monks some nights, but this night he has returned to his formal home in Joe Kung. A handful of monks prefer their austere quarters here to the formal monastery in Joe Kung, including Chim Din, Lapsang Samten, and the woman Donka Nyapso. Occasionally the flyer, Lomo, stays at the monks' quarters or in an empty shrine here, but not tonight. Lomo has left early for the winter palace, having mentioned his thought of climbing Nanda Devi south of Potala. So while I can see a soft lantern glow coming from the monks' quarters hundreds of meters away on the lowest level of the eastern edge of the complex, a glow that is extinguished even as I watch it, the rest of the temple complex is dark and quiet in the starlight. Neither the oracle nor the other bright moons have risen yet, although the eastern horizon is beginning to glow a bit with their coming. The stars are incredibly bright, almost as brilliant and unwavering as when seen from space. There are thousands visible this night, more than I remembered from Hyperion's or Old Earth's night sky, and I crane my neck until I can see the slowly moving star that is the tiny moon where the ship is presumably hiding. I am carrying the comm unit Disky journal, and all it would take is a whisper to query the ship, but Ania and I have decided that with the pack so near, even tight beam transmissions to or from the ship should be reserved for emergency situations. I sincerely hope that no emergency situations will arise soon. Taking the ladders, staircases, and short bridges down the west side of the temple complex, I walk back along the brick and stone ledge beneath the lowest structures. The night wind has come up, and I can hear the crack and groan of the wooden timbers as entire platform levels adjust themselves to the wind and chill. Prayer flags flap above me, and I see starlight on the cloud tops, where they curl against the ridge rock so far below. The wind is not quite strong enough to make the distinctive wolf's howl that woke me my first few nights here, but its passage through the fissures and timbers and cracks sets the world muttering and whispering around me. I reach the wisdom staircase and climb up through the right understanding meditation pavilion, standing a moment at the balcony to look out at the dark and silent monk's quarters perched by itself on a boulder to the east. I recognize the infinite wood-carving skill and care of the sisters, Kuku and Keisei, in the elaborate carvings just under my fingertips here. Wrapping my jacket tighter in the rising wind, I climb the spiral staircase to the platform pagoda for right thought. On the east wall of this restored pagoda, Ania has designed a large, perfectly round window, looking east toward the dip in the ridgeline there, where the oracle makes its first appearance. And the moon is rising now, its bright rays illuminating first the ceiling of this pagoda and then the rear wall, where these words from the Sutta Nipata scripture are set into the plaster wall. As a flame blown out by the wind goes to rest and cannot be defined, so the wise man freed from individuality goes to rest and cannot be defined. Gone beyond all images. Gone beyond the power of words. I know that this passage deals with the enigmatic death of Buddha, but I read it in the moonlight with the thought of how it might apply to Ania or myself or the two of us. It does not seem to apply, Unlike the monks who labor here for enlightenment, I have no urge whatsoever to go beyond individuality. The world itself, all of the myriad worlds I have been privileged to see and walk upon, are what fascinate and delight me. I have no wish to put the world and my sense images of the world behind me. And I know that Aeneas feels the same about life, that involvement with it is like the Catholic communion. Only the world is the host, and it must be chewed. Still, the thought of the essence of things, of people, of life going beyond all images and the power of words, this resonates with me. I have been trying and failing to put even the essence of this place, these days, into words and discovering the futility of it. Leaving the wisdom axis, I cross the long platform for cooking and common meals and begin up the morality axis of stairways, bridges, and platforms. The oracle is free of the ridgeline now, and the light from it and its two attendants paint the rock and red wood around me in thick moon paint. I pass through the pavilions for right speech and right action, pausing to catch my breath in the circular pagoda for right livelihood. There is a bamboo barrel of drinking water just outside the pagoda for right effort, and I drink deeply there. Prayer flags flutter and snap along the terraces and eaves as I move softly across the long connecting platform to the highest structures. The meditation pavilion for right mindfulness is part of Aeneas' recent work and still smells of fresh bonsai cedar. 10 meters higher along the steep ladder, the right meditation pavilion perches out over the bulk of the temple, its window looking out on the ridge wall. I stand there for several minutes, realizing for the first time that the shadow of the pagoda itself falls upon that slab of rock when the moon is rising, as it is now, and that Aeneas has designed the roof of the pavilion so that its shadow connects with natural clefts and discolorations in the rock to create a shadow character that I recognize as the Chinese character for Buddha. At this moment I am taken by a chill, although the wind is not blowing any harder than it has been. Goosebumps rise along my forearms and the back of my neck feels cold. I realize, no, see, in that instant, that Aeneas' mission, whatever it is doomed to failure. She and I are both going to be captured, interrogated, probably tortured and executed. My promises to the old poet on Hyperion were so much wasted breath. Bring down the Pax, I had said. The Pax, with its billions of faithful, millions of men and women in arms, thousands of warships. Bring back old Earth, I had agreed. Well, I had visited it. I look out the window to see the sky, but there is only the rock wall in the moonlight and the slowly cohering shadow character of the Buddha's name, the three vertical strokes like ink on slate-colored vellum, the three horizontal strokes flowing around and together, making three white faces in the negative spaces, three faces staring at me in the dark. I had promised to protect Aeneas. I vow that I will die doing that. Shaking off the chill and the premonition, I go out onto the meditation platform, clip to a cable, and hum 30 meters across the void to the platform below the top terrace, where Aeneas and I have sleeping pagodas. As I climb the last ladder to the highest level, I am thinking, perhaps I will sleep now. I made no notes on this in the Disky journal. I remember it now as I write it. Aeneas' light was out. I was pleased. She stayed up too late, worked too hard. The high work scaffolds and cliff cables were no place for an exhausted architect. I stepped into my own shack, slid shut the shoji door, and kicked off my boots. Things were as I had left them. The outer screen walls slid back a bit, moonlight bright across my sleeping mat, the wind rattling the walls in its soft conversation with the mountains. Neither of my lanterns was lit, but I had the light from the moon and my memory of the small room in the dark. The floor was bare tatami except for my sleeping futon and a single chest near the door that held my rucksack, few food items, beer mug, the rebreathers I'd brought from the ship, and my climbing gear. There was nothing to trip over. I hung my jacket on the hook near the door, splashed water on my face from the basin in the chest, and stripped off my shirt, socks, trousers, and underwear, stuffing them into the ditty bag in the chest. Tomorrow was laundry day. Sighing, feeling the premonition of doom I'd felt in the meditation pavilion now fading into simple fatigue, I walked over to the sleeping mat. I have always slept naked, except for when in the home guard and during my trip in the consul's ship with my two friends. There was the slightest of movements in the darkness beyond the bright strip of moonlight, and, startled, I dropped into a fighting crouch. Nakedness makes one feel more vulnerable than usual. Then I realized a Bedick must have returned early. I unclenched my right fist. "Rahl?" said Ania. She leaned forward into the moonlight. She had wrapped my sleeping blanket around the lower part of her body, but her shoulders and breasts and abdomen were bare. The oracle touched her hair and cheekbones with soft light. I opened my mouth to speak, started to turn back toward my clothes or jacket, decided not to walk that far, and dropped on one knee to the sleeping mat, pulling up the futon's sheet to cover myself. I was not a prude, but this was Ania. What was she? "Rahl," she said again. And this time there was no question in her voice. She moved closer to me on her knees. The blanket fell away from her. "Ania," I said stupidly. "Ania, you don't really... She set her finger on my lips and removed it a second later. But before I could speak, she leaned closer and pressed her lips where her finger had been. Every time I had ever touched my young friend, the contact had been electric. I have described this before and always felt foolish discussing it, but I ascribed it to her, an aura, a charge of personality. It was real, not a metaphor. But never had I felt the surge of electricity between us as in this instant. For a second, I was passive, receiving the kiss rather than sharing in it. But then the warmth and insistence of it overcame thought, overcame doubt, overcame all of my other senses and every nuance of the word. And then I was returning her kiss, putting my arms around her to pull her closer, even as she slid her arms under mine and ran strong fingers up my back. More than 5 years ago for her, when she had kissed me farewell at the river on old Earth, her kiss had been urgent, electric, filled with questions and messages, but still a 16-year-old girl's kiss. This kiss was the warm, moist, open touch of a woman, and I responded to it in an instant. We kissed for an eternity. I was vaguely aware of my own nudity and excitement as something I should be concerned about, embarrassed about. But it was a distant thing, secondary to the expanding warmth and urgency of the kisses that would not stop. When finally our lips came apart, feeling swollen, almost bruised, wanting to be kissed again, we kissed each other's cheeks, eyelids, forehead, ears. I lowered my face and kissed the hollow of her throat, feeling the pulse against my lips there and inhaling the perfumed scent of her skin. She moved forward on her knees, arching her back slightly so that her breasts touched my cheek. I cupped one and kissed the nipple almost reverently. Ania cupped the back of my head in her palm. I could feel her breath on me quickening as she bowed her face toward me. "Wait, wait," I said, pulling my face up and leaning back. "No, Ania, are you... I mean, I don't think..." "Shh," she said, leaning over me again, kissing me again, pulling back so that her dark eyes seemed to fill the world. "Shh, Rahl. Yes." She kissed me again, leaning to her right so that we both reclined on the sleeping mat, still kissing, the rising breeze rattling the rice paper walls, the entire platform rocking to the depth of our kiss and the motion of our bodies. It is a problem to tell of such things, to share the most private and sacred of moments. It feels like a violation to put such things into words, and a lie not to. To see and feel one's beloved naked for the first time is one of life's pure, irreducible epiphanies. If there is a true religion in the universe, it must include that truth of contact or be forever hollow. To make love to the one true person who deserves that love is one of the few absolute rewards of being a human being, balancing all of the pain, loss, awkwardness, loneliness, idiocy, compromise, and clumsiness that go with the human condition. To make love to the right person makes up for a lot of mistakes. I had never made love to the right person before. I knew that, even as Ania and I first kissed and lay against each other, even before we began moving slowly, then quickly, then slowly again, I realized that I had never really made love to anyone before, that the young soldier on leave sex with friendly women, or the bargeman and bargewoman we have the opportunity, so why not sex, that I had thought, explored, and discovered everything to do with the subject was not even the beginning. This was the beginning. I remember Ania rising above me at one point, her hand hard on my chest, her own chest slick with sweat. But she was still looking at me so intensely and so warmly, that it was as if we were connected intimately by our gaze, as surely as by our thighs and genitals. And I was to remember that instant every time we made love in the future, even as I seem to be remembering forward to all those future times, even during these first few moments of our intimacy. Lying together in the moonlight, the sheets and blankets and the futon curled and thrown around us, the cool wind from the north drying the sweat on our bodies, her cheek on my chest and my thigh across her hip, we kept touching each other, her fingers playing with the hair on my chest, my fingers tracing the line of her cheek, the sole of my foot sliding up and down the back of her leg, curling around her strong calf muscles. "Was this a mistake?" I whispered. "No," she whispered back. "Unless..." My heart pounded. "Unless what?" "Unless you didn't get those shots in the home guard that I'm sure you got," she whispered. I was so anxious that I did not hear the teasing quality in her voice. "What? Shots? What?" I said, rolling onto my elbow. "Oh, shots. Shit, you know I did, Jesus."
"I know you did," whispered Ania,
and I could hear the smile now. When we Hyperion lads had joined the home guard, the authorities had given us the usual battery of PAX-approved injections. Anti-malaria, anti-cancer, antivirus, and birth control. In a PAX universe where the vast majority of individuals chose the cruciform, chose to attempt to be immortal, birth control was a given. One could apply to PAX authorities for the antidote after marriage or simply buy it on the black market when it was time to start a family. Or if one chose neither the way of the cross nor a family, it would last until old age or death made the issue moot. I had not thought of that shot for years. Actually, I think Abedic had asked me about those shots on the consul's ship a decade ago when we were discussing preventative medicine and I had mentioned the home guard induction battery. Our young friend of 11 or 12 curled on a couch there on the hollow pit level, reading a book from the ship's library, seemingly not paying attention at all. "No," I said, still on my elbow. "I mean a mistake. You're...
me,"
she whispered. 21 standard years old," I finished. "I'm
you,"
she whispered. 11 standard years older than that."
"Incredible," said Ania.
Her whole face was in the moonlight as she looked up at me.
"You can do math at such a moment."
I sighed and rolled over on my stomach. The sheets smelled of us. The wind was still rising, and now it rattled the walls.
"I'm cold," whispered Ania.
In the days and months to come, I would have held her in my arms if she said such a thing. But that night I responded literally and stood to slide shut the shoji screen. The wind was colder than usual.
"No," she said.
"What?"
"Don't close it all the way."
She was sitting up, with the sheet raised to just below her breasts.
But it's the moonlight on you, Aniya whispered.
Her voice may have caused my physical response, or the sight of her waiting for me in the blankets. Besides holding in our own scents, the room smelled like fresh straw because of the new tatami and the ryokan in the ceiling, and of the fresh, cool air of the mountains. But the cold breeze did not slow my reaction to her.
Come here, she whispered,
and opened the blanket like a cape to fold me in. The next morning, and I am working on setting the overhang walkway in place, and it is as if I am sleepwalking. Part of the problem is lack of sleep. The oracle had said, and the east was paling with morning when Aniya slipped back to her own pavilion. But the major reason is sheer, simple stupefaction. Life has taken a turn that I had never anticipated, never imagined. I am setting supports into the cliff for the high walk with the high riggers Haruyuki, Kenshiro, and Wojtek Meyer moving ahead, drilling holes in the stone, while Kim Byung-soon and Vicky Grosselge lay brick behind and beneath us, and carpenter Chang-chi Kenchung begins work behind me on the laying of the wood floor of the terrace itself. There would be nothing to catch the high riggers and me if we fall from the wooden beams, if Lomo had not done his free-climbing exhibition yesterday and set fixed ropes and cables in place. Now, as we jump from beam to beam, we just clip one of our harness carabiners into place on the next rope. I have fallen before and had the fall arrested by this sort of fixed rope. Each can hold 5 times my weight. Now I leap from set beam to set beam, pulling along the next beam as it dangles from one of the cables. The wind is coming up and threatens to hurl me off into space, but I balance myself with one hand touching the hanging beam and 3 fingers on the rock face itself. I reach the end of the 3rd fixed rope, unclip and prepare to clip onto the 4th of 7 lines Lomo has rigged. I do not know what to think about last night. That is, I know how I feel. Exhilarated, confused, ecstatic, in love. But I don't know how to think about it. I tried to intercept Aniya before breakfast in the communal dining pavilion near the monks' quarters, but she had already eaten and headed far out to where the terrace carvers had run into trouble on the new eastern walkway. Then A. Bedick, George Sarong, and Jigme Norbu had shown up with the porters, and an hour or two was consumed sorting materials and transporting the beams, chisels, lumber, and other items to the new high scaffolds. I had headed out onto the eastern ledge before the beam work began, but A. Bedick and Sipon Shakapa were conferring with Aniya, so I jogged back to the scaffolds and got busy. Now I was jumping to the last beam set in place this morning, ready to install the next one in the hole Haruyuki and Kenshiro have chiseled and blasted into the rock with tiny shaped charges. Then Wojtek and Vicky will cement the post in place. Within 30 minutes, it will be firm enough for Chang-chi to set a work platform on. I've become accustomed to leaping from beam to beam, catching my balance and squatting to set the next beam in place, and I do so now on the last beam, pinwheeling my left arm to keep my balance while my fingers stay in contact with the beam balancing from the cable. Suddenly, the beam swings out too far ahead of me, and I am off balance, leaning into nothing. I know that the safety line will catch me, but I hate to fall and be dangling here between the last beam and the newly drilled hole. If I don't have enough momentum to kick back to the beam, I'll have to wait for Kenshiro or one of the other riggers to kick out and rescue me. In a fraction of a second, I make up my mind and jump, catching the swinging beam and kicking out hard. Because the safety rope has several meters of slack before it will catch me, all of my weight is on my fingers now. The beam is too thick for me to get a good grip on it, and I can feel my fingers sliding on the iron hard wood. But rather than go dropping to the elastic end of my fixed line, I struggle to hang on, succeed in swinging the heavy post back toward the last beam in place, and jump the last 2 meters, landing on the slippery beam and flailing my arms for balance. Laughing at my own foolishness, I catch my balance and stand panting for a moment, watching the clouds boiling against the rock several 1,000 meters below my feet. Chang-chi Kenchung is leaping from beam to beam toward me, clipping onto the fixed ropes with a rapid urgency. There is something like horror in his eyes, and for a second I am sure that something has happened to Aniya. My heart begins beating so hard, and anxiety washes over me so swiftly that I almost lose my balance. But I catch it again and stand balancing on the last fixed beam, waiting for Chang-Chi with a sense of dread. When he leaps to the last beam with me, Chang-Chi is too winded to speak. He gestures toward me urgently, but I do not understand the motion. Perhaps he has seen my comical swing and dance and leap with the dangling beam and was concerned. To show him that it was all right, I reach up to my harness line to show him that the carabiner is locked tight to the safety line. There is no carabiner there. I never tied on to the last fixed rope. I have been doing all this leaping, balancing, hanging, and jumping with no safety line. There has been nothing between me and... Feeling a sudden stab of vertigo and nausea, I stagger 3 steps to the cliff wall and lean against the cold stone. The overhang tries to push me away, and it is as if the entire mountain is tilting outward, pushing me off the beam. Chang-Chi tugs Lomo's fixed line around, lifts a beaner from my harness rack and clips me on. I nod my appreciation and try not to lose my breakfast while he is here with me. 10 meters around the bend in the cliff, Haruyuki and Kenshiro are gesturing. They have blasted another perfect hole. They want me to catch up with setting the beams in place. The party departing for the Dalai Lama's evening reception for the PAX at Patala leaves just after the noon meal in the common dining hall. I see Ania there, but except for a meaningful exchange of glances and a smile from her that makes my knees weak, we have no private communication. We assemble on the lowest level with hundreds of workers, monks, cooks, scholars, and porters waving and cheering from the platforms above. Rain clouds are beginning to curl and spill between the low gaps in the eastern ridgeline. But the sky above Suan Kung Su is still blue, and the red prayer flags flapping from the high terraces stand out with almost shocking clarity. We are all dressed in travel clothes, our formal reception clothing carried in waterproof shoulder strap satchels or, in my case, my rucksack. The Dalai Lama's receptions are traditionally held late at night, and we have more than 10 hours until our presence is required. But it is a 6-hour trip on the highway, and couriers and one flyer coming into Zhou Kung earlier that day have told of bad weather beyond the Kunlun Ridge, so we step off lively enough. The order of march is set by protocol. Charles Chi Kyap Kempo, mayor of Zhou Kung and Lord Chamberlain of the temple hanging in air, walks a few paces ahead of his near peer, Kempo Nga Wang Tashi, abbot of the temple. Both men's traveling clothes are more resplendent than my shot at formal wear, and they are surrounded by small hornet clusters of aides, monks, and security people. Behind the priest politicians walk Gyalo Thondup, the young monk and cousin to the current Dalai Lama, and Lobsang Samten, the third-year monk who is the Dalai Lama's brother. They have the easy stride and easier laugh of young men at the peak of physical health and mental clarity. Their white teeth gleam in their brown faces. Lobsang is wearing a brilliant red climbing chuba that gives the appearance of him being an ambulatory prayer flag in our procession as we head west along the narrow walkway to the Zhou Kung Fissure. Tsipon Shakapa, the official overseer of Ania's project, walks with George Sarong, our chubby construction foreman. George's inseparable companion, Jigme Norbu, is absent now. His feelings hurt by not being invited. Jigme has stayed behind at the temple. I believe that this is the first time that I have seen George where he is not smiling. Tsipon makes up for George's silence, however, telling stories with waving arms and extravagant gestures. Several of their workers hike with them, at least as far as Zhou Kung. Tromo Trochi of Domu, the flamboyant trade agent from the south, walks with his only companion for so many months on the highways, an oversized zygote packbrid laden with the trader's goods. The zygote has 3 bells hung from its shaggy neck, and they chime like the temple's prayer bells as we walk along. Lomo Dondrub is to meet us in Potala, but his presence in the party is represented symbolically on the zygote's topmost pack duffel by a swatch of new flight fabric for his paraglider. Ania and I bring up the rear of the procession. Several times I try to talk about last night, but she silences me with a finger to her lips and a nod in the direction of the nearby trader and other members of the procession. I settle for small talk about the last days of work on the temple overhang pavilion and walkways, but my mind continues to jostle with questions. Soon we are in Jokung, where the ramps and walkways are lined with crowds waving pennants and prayer flags. From the fisher terraces and cliff shacks, citizens of the city cheer their mayor and the rest of us. Just beyond the fisher city of Jokung, near the jump-off platforms of the only cableway we will be using on this trip to Potala, we encounter another party headed to the Dalai Lama's reception, the Dorje Phamo and her 9 female priests. The Dorje Phamo travels in a palanquin carried by 4 heavily muscled males because she is the abbess of Samden Gompa, an all-male monastery some 30 clicks out along the south wall of the same ridge that holds the temple hanging in air along its north wall. The Dorje Phamo is 94 standard years old and was discovered to be the incarnation of the original Dorje Phamo, the Thunderbolt Sow, when she was 3 standard years old. She is a woman of immense importance and a separate monastery for women, the Oracle Gampa at Yamdrok Tso, some 60 clicks farther along the dangerous ridge wall, has held her as its prefect and avatar for more than 70 standard years. Now the Thunderbolt Sow, her 9 female priest companions, and about 30 male carriers and guards are waiting at the cableway to attach the palanquin's massive carabiner clamps. The Dorje Phamo peers through her curtains, spies our party, and beckons Ania over. I know from Ania's offhand comments that she has traveled to the Oracle Gompa at Yamdrok Tso several times to meet with the Sow, and that the two are fast friends. I also know from A. Bedick's comments to me in confidence that the Dorje Phamo has recently told her female priests and monks at the Oracle Gompa, and the male monks at Samden Gompa, that it is Ania, not His Holiness the current Dalai Lama, who is the incarnation of the living Buddha of Mercy. Word of this heresy has spread, according to A. Bedick, but because of the Thunderbolt Sow's popularity across the world of Chen Shan, the Dalai Lama has not yet responded to the impertinence. Now I watch as the two women, my young Ania and the ancient form in the palanquin, chat and laugh easily as both parties wait to cross the cableway across the Langma Abyss. The Dorje Phamo must have insisted that we precede her group, for the carriers move the palanquin back out of the way and the 9 female priests bow deeply as Ania motions our group forward on the platform. Charles Chikyap Kempo and Kempo Nga Wang Tashi look discomfited as they allow their aides to clip them onto the cable. Not out of concern for their safety, I know, but out of some breach of protocol that I missed and am not particularly interested in. At that moment, I am interested in getting Ania alone and talking with her, or perhaps just kissing her again. It rains hard during the walk to Potala. During my 3 months here, I've experienced more than a few summer showers, but this is a serious pre-monsoon rain, chilling, icy, with curling tendrils of fog that close around us. We clear the 1 cableway transit before the clouds close in, but by the time we are approaching the east side of the Kunlun Ridge, the highway is slick with ice. The highway consists of rock ledges, bricked pathways on the sheer cliffside, high wooden walkways along the northwest ridge of Hua Shan, the Flower Mountain, and a long series of platform walkways and suspension bridges connecting those icy ridgelines with Kunlun. Then there is the second longest suspension bridge on the planet connecting Kunlun Ridge with Fari Ridge, followed by another series of walkways, bridges, and ledges heading southwest along the east face of Fari Ridge to Fari Marketplace. There we pass through the fissure and follow the ledge road almost due west to Potala. Normally this is a 6-hour walk in the sunshine, but this afternoon it is a dreary, dangerous trudge through the curling fog and icy rain. The aides traveling with Mayor Lord Chamberlain Charles Chikyap Kempo and Abbot Kempo Nga Wang Tashi attempt to shelter their worthies under bright red and yellow umbrellas. But the icy ledge is often narrow, and the worthies frequently must get wet as they go ahead in single file. The suspension bridges are nightmares to cross. The floor of each is just a single, heavily braided hemp cable with hemp ropes rising vertically, horizontal side ropes for railings, and a second thick cable above one's head. And although it is usually child's play to balance on the lower cable while keeping contact with the side ropes, it takes complete concentration in this driving rain. But all of the locals have done this through dozens of monsoons, and they move along quickly. It is only Ania and I who hesitate as the bridges flex and toss under the party's weight, the icy ropes threatening to slip out of our hands. Despite the storm, or perhaps because of it, someone has lighted the highway torches all along the east face of Fari Ridge, and the braziers burning through the thick fog help us find our way as the wooden walkways turn, bend, rise, descend icy staircases, and lead out to more bridges. We arrive in Fari Marketplace just at dusk, although it seems much later because of the gloom. Other groups bound for the Winter Palace join us there, and there are at least 70 people headed west together past the fissure. The Dorji Famos palanquin still bobs along with us, and I suspect that others besides myself are a bit envious of her dry perch in there. I confess that I am disappointed. We had planned to arrive at Patala in the twilight, while there was still alpenglow lighting the north-south ridges and the higher peaks to the north and west of the palace. I have never glimpsed the palace before, and I had been looking forward to seeing this region. As it is, the broad highway between Fari and Potala is just a series of torch-lit ledges and walkways. I have brought the flashlight laser in my pack, although whether as a futile gesture for defense should things turn bad at the palace, or for finding our way in the dark, I am not sure. Ice coats the rocks, the platforms, the hemp cable railings along this most well-traveled of walkways, as well as the stairs. I cannot imagine being on the cableway this night, but rumor has it that several of the more adventurous guests are traveling that way. We arrive at the Forbidden City some 2 hours before the reception is scheduled to begin. The clouds have lifted a bit, the rain relents, and our first glimpse of the Winter Palace takes my breath away and makes me forget my disappointment of not having approached it in the twilight. The Winter Palace is built on a great peak rising from the Yellow Hat Ridge, with the higher peaks of Koko Nor behind it. And our first glimpse through the clouds is of Dre Pung, the surrounding monastery that houses 35,000 monks, tier upon tier of tall stone buildings rising up the vertical slopes, its thousands of windows glowing with lantern light, torches at balconies, terraces, and entrances, while behind the Dre Pung and above it, with gold roofs touching the ceiling of boiling clouds, rises Potala, the Winter Palace of the Dalai Lama, ablaze with light and backlighted, even in the stormy darkness, by the lightning-lit peaks of the Koko Nor. The aides and fellow travelers turn back here, and only we invited pilgrims press on into the Forbidden City. The highway now flattens and broadens to a true highway, an avenue 50 meters wide, paved with gold stones, lined with torches and surrounded by countless temples, chortens, lesser gompas, outbuildings for the imposing monastery and military guard posts. The rain has stopped, but the avenue glistens goldly, while hundreds upon hundreds of brightly garbed pilgrims and residents of the Forbidden City bustle to and fro in front of the huge walls and gates of the Dre Pung and the Potala. Monks in saffron robes move in small, silent groups. Palace officials in brilliant red and rich purple gowns and yellow hats looking like inverted saucers walk purposefully past soldiers in blue uniforms with black and white striped pikes. Official messengers jog by in skin-tight outfits of orange and red or gold and blue. Women of the court glide across the gold stones in long silk dresses of sky blue, deep lapis lazuli, and daring cobalt, their trains making soft, slithering sounds on the wet pavement. Priests from the Red Hat sect are instantly recognizable with their inverted saucer hats of crimson silk and crimson fringe, while the Drungpas, the wooded valley people, stride by with woolly hats of zygote fur, their costumes adorned with brilliant white, red, tan, and gold feathers, carrying their great gold ceremonial swords tucked into their sashes. Finally, the common folk of the Forbidden City are little less colorful than the high officials. The cooks and gardeners, and servants and tutors, and masons and personal valets, all bedecked in silk chubas of green and blue, or gold and orange, those who work in the Dalai Lama's quarters of the Winter Palace, several thousand strong, glimpsed in the crimson and gold, everyone wearing the zygote-banded silk hats with stiff brims some 50 centimeters broad, to preserve their pale palace complexions on sunny days, and to ward off the rain during monsoon season. Our wet band of pilgrims seems dull and shabby in these surroundings, but I have little thought of our own appearance as we pass through a 60-meter-tall gate in one of the outer walls of the Drepung Monastery, and begin to cross the Ki Chu Bridge. This bridge is 20 meters wide, 115 meters long, and made of the most modern carbon plasteel. It shines like black chrome. Beneath it is nothing. The bridge spans a terminal fissure in the ridgeline and drops thousands of meters to the phosgene clouds below. On the east side, the side from which we approach, the structures of the Drepung rise 2 or 3 kilometers above us. Flat walls and glowing windows, and the air above us laced with spiderweb upon spiderweb of official cable shortcuts between the monastery and the palace proper. On the west side, ahead of us, the Potala rises more than 6 kilometers on the cliff faces. Its thousands of stone facets and hundreds of gold roofs reflecting the flickering lightning from the low clouds above it. In case of attack, the Ki Chu Bridge can retract into the western cliff in less than 30 seconds, leaving no stairway, foothold, ledge, or window for 0.5 kilometer of vertical stone to the ramparts above. The bridge does not retract as we cross it. The sides are lined with troopers in ceremonial garb, each carrying a deadly serious pike or energy rifle. At the far end of the Ki Chu, we pause at the Pargo Kaling, the western gate, an ornate arch 85 meters tall. Light glows from within the giant arch, breaking out through 1,000 intricate designs, the brightest glow coming from the 2 great eyes, each more than 10 meters across, that stare unblinkingly across the Ki Chu and the Drepung to the east. We each pause as we pass under the Pargo Kaling. Our first step beyond it will bring us onto the grounds of the Winter Palace itself, although the actual doorway is still some 30 paces ahead of us. Inside that doorway are the 1,000 steps that will take us up to the palace proper. Ania has told me that pilgrims have come from all over Tian Shan by walking on their knees, or in some cases by prostrating themselves at every step, literally measuring the hundreds or thousands of kilometers with their bodies, just to be allowed to pass under the western gate and to touch this last section of the Ki Chu Bridge with their foreheads out of homage to the Dalai Lama. Ania and I step across together, glancing at one another. After presenting our invitations to the guards and officials within the main entrance portal, we ascend the 1,000 stairs. I am amazed to find that the stairway is an escalator, although Tromo Trochi of Domu whispers that it is often left unactivated to allow the faithful a final exertion before being allowed into the upper reaches of the palace. Above, on the first public levels, there is another flurry of invitation checking, servants divesting us of our wet outer robes, and other servants escorting us to rooms in which we might bathe and change. Lord Chamberlain Charles Chikyap Kempo is entitled to a small suite of rooms on the 78th level of the palace. And after what seems like farther kilometers of walking down outside halls, the windows to our right showing the red rooftops of the Drepung Monastery flickering and gleaming in the stormlight, we are greeted by more servants given over to our bidding. Each of our party has at least a curtained alcove in which we will sleep after the formal reception, and adjoining bathrooms offer hot water, baths, and modern sonic showers. I follow Ania, and smile at her when she winks on her way out of the steamy room. I had no truly formal clothes at the temple hanging in air, nor any in the ship currently hiding on the third moon, for that matter, but Lomo Dondrub and some of the others roughly my size have fitted me out for tonight's honor. Black trousers and highly polished high black boots, a white silk shirt under a gold vest with a red and black X-shaped wool overvest, tied together at the waist with a crimson silk sash. The formal evening cape is made of the finest warrior silk from the western reaches of Mustach Alta, and is mostly black, but with intricate border designs of red, gold, silver, and yellow. It is Lomo's second-best cape, and he made it quite clear that he would toss me from the highest platform if I stained, tore, or lost it. Lomo is a pleasant, easygoing man, almost unheard of in a lone flyer, I am told, but I think he was not kidding about this. A. Bedick loaned me the requisite silver bracelets for the reception, these purchased by him on a whim in the beautiful markets of Si Wang Mu. Over my shoulders, I place the feather and zygote wool-red hood loaned to me by Jigme Norbu, who has waited his entire life in vain for an invitation to the Winter Palace. Around my neck is a jade and silver link Middle Kingdom formal talisman, courtesy of master carpenter and friend Chang-Chi Kencheng, who told me this morning that he has been to 3 receptions at the palace and has been bored witless each time. Servants in gold silk come to our chambers to announce that it is time for us to congregate in the main reception hall next to the throne room. The outside corridors are filled with hundreds of guests moving along the tiled halls. Silk is rustling, jewelry rattles, and the air is filled with a clash of perfume and cologne and soap and leather. Ahead of us, I get a glimpse of the ancient Dorji Famo, the Thunderbolt Sow herself, being helped along by 2 of her 9 female priests, all of them in elegant saffron gowns. The sow wears no jewelry, but her white hair is tied and ribboned in elaborate mounds and beautiful braids. Ania's gown is simple but breathtaking, a deep blue silk, with a cobalt hood covering her otherwise bare shoulders, 1 Middle Kingdom talisman of silver and jade dropping to her bosom, and a silver comb pinned in her hair, holding a thin half-veil in place. Many of the women in view are veiled for modesty tonight, and I realize how cleverly this disguises my friend's appearance. She takes my arm and we move in procession down the endless corridors, turning right and gliding up spiral escalators toward the Dalai Lama's levels. I lean close and whisper against her veiled ear. Nervous? I see the glint of her smile beneath the veil, and she squeezes my hand. Persisting, I whisper, "Kiddo, you sometimes see the future. I know you do. So, do we get out of this alive tonight?" I bend over as she leans close to whisper back, "Only a few things in anyone's future are set, Rawl. Most things are as liquid as..." She gestures toward a swirling fountain that we pass and spiral above. "But I see no reason to worry, do you? There are thousands of guests here tonight. The Dalai Lama can greet only a few in person. His guests, the packs, whoever they will be, have no reason to think that we are here." I nod, but am not convinced. Suddenly, Labsang Samten, the Dalai Lama's brother, comes racketing down the ascending escalator in violation of all protocol. The monk is grinning and bubbling over with enthusiasm. He addresses our group, but hundreds on the rising staircase lean in to listen. "The guests from space are very important," he says enthusiastically. "I have been talking to our tutor, who is the assistant to the second in command to the Minister of Protocol. These are not just missionaries whom we greet tonight."
"No," says the Lord Chamberlain, Charles Chikyap Kempo, resplendent in his many layers of red and gold silk.
"No," grins Lapsang Samten. "It is a cardinal of the Pax Church, a very important cardinal, with several of his top people."
I feel my stomach churn and then drop into free fall.
"Which cardinal?" says Ania. Her voice seems calm and interested.
We are approaching the top of the spiral staircase ride, and the sound of hundreds or thousands of softly murmuring guests fills the air. Labsang Samten straightens his formal monk's robe.
"A Cardinal Mustafa," he says brightly. "Someone very close to the Pax Pope, I think. The Pax honors my brother by sending him as ambassador."
I feel Ania's hand close on my arm.
but I cannot see her expression clearly through the veil.
And several other important Pax guests, continues the monk, turning as we approach the reception level, including some strange Pax women, military types, I think.
Did you get their names? Asks Ania.
One of them, says Lapsang. General Nemes. She is very pale.
The Dalai Lama's brother turns his wide, sincere smile on Ania.
The Cardinal has asked to meet you specifically, Emania. You and your escort, Emendymion. The protocol minister was very surprised, but has arranged for a private reception for you with the Pax people and the regent and, of course, my brother, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
Our ascent ends. The staircase slides into the marble floor. With Ania on my arm, I step out into the noise and tightly controlled chaos of the main reception hall.